Football Weekly with James Richardson in association with SportingBet.com.
Football Weekly. Today, chaos in Angola. The tournament kicks off with an extraordinary opening game, but after Friday's shocking attack on Togo squad, what next for the Nations Cup? Elsewhere, Premier League shivers for Arsenal against Everton, while at St Andrews, Cameron leads Blues to a point and United Labour to stay in leadership race. Plus, while we wait for the big thaw, we ask who decides which clubs can get off games. There's a smattering of transfer talk, Sid on Spanish teen dream Sergio Canales, and an extra helping of macaroni in our Serie A roundup. All that, plus posts with more thought-provoking comments and suggestions than Tom Hicks Jr.'s outbox. All in Football Weekly. And welcome on board, everybody. Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
And Sean Ingle.
Hello.
Kevin McCarra will be along shortly. I believe we'll also have a Paolo Bandini beaming up for part three as well. But we kick off in part one with the Nations Cup. All football really overshadowed by the events in Angola over the last few days. Three dead, of course, in Togo's party after the shooting of their team bus. Togo withdrawing from the tournament today, the organisers confirming that they won't be allowed to then return after their 3 days of national mourning. And big question marks really over the tournament as a whole, and particularly the games that are going to be held in the province of Cabinda. The separatist organisation FLEC, who claimed responsibility for the shooting, who originally said this is going to be the beginning of a series of targeted actions that are going to continue across the territory, which is worrying news for everybody, and, you know, in football terms, so the team's based there. Today, I noticed that they are saying that they only hit the Togo players by accident. They were actually they weren't the target or anything. They were just shooting at Angolan security forces. But Barry, as you were pointing out, it's curious how they didn't manage to hit any of them, but did hit at least five of the Togo party.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a strange explanation. And even if they were aiming at Angolan security force members, I would imagine the fact that those security forces were accompanying the Togo team bus was no coincidence. You know, I'm sure there are other police or army personnel they could have shot at.
And equally, the other teams are going to have security forces around them, which is...
Exactly. And even more now that security has been stepped up. I mean, you'd have to ask why the Togo team bus was driving through Cabinda in the first place and why there are even games in Cabinda.
Because you can't take the roads there.
Yeah, Cabinda isn't in Angola. It's part of Angola, but it's not in Angola. It's an exclave, which means it's separate to the country. And it's full of terrorist activity, and quite why there were games there in the first place just seems crazy.
Well, Angola, one of the organising, I think maybe a member of the government, immediately after the attack said this is, Togo to an extent are responsible for this because we told everyone not to take road transport and fly in, and they didn't give us their details or anything, and they just made their own way there. But why you would be organising an event in somewhere where it's not safe to take the roads is bizarre. Why Togo did this, and there's a lot of talk that their federation aren't known for paying air bills, and the players probably had a whip round to organise the transport themselves. I don't know, all sorts of stories flying around, because one of the things about this is that it's just been chaos from the moment of the shooting onwards. Stories about players dying, then confirmed to still be alive, the team withdrawing, the team deciding to play on, the Prime Minister of Togo then saying, no, you're coming home, and... understandable.
Yeah, exactly. Is that surprising? God, if I played for a football team and my teammates were shot out, in the hospital, and the people that I've worked and known for years had been killed, would you want to go back to work?
Fair point, indeed. As you say, Sean, let's now hear from our man in Angola, Jonathan Wilson. Jonathan, what's the mood like? Has this sunk in, the events of Friday, to people in Angola?
Well, to be honest, I don't think the mood's really been affected by it in Luanda. I think among players and among journalists here, there's obviously been distress and shock and a bit of anxiety. Certainly during the opening ceremony last night when the fireworks started going off, I'm sure I wasn't the only one who started clinching. But I think among Angolan fans and the people in Luanda, they had a 27-year civil war which only came to an end in 2002. But I think that it's so inured to violence and to tragedies like this that really they don't seem that bothered by it. And I mean, obviously the mood's quite muted last night after the game, conceding four goals in the last 11 minutes. But up until then, you wouldn't have known there was anything untoward. The opening ceremony was a very good opening ceremony. The fans were going mad when they were 4-0 up. the atmosphere outside the stadium before the ground, a huge traffic jam going to the game, fans kind of singing and dancing, kind of blowing their trumpets. So it was all actually quite normal.
So it's just business as usual. What's going to happen, though? We hear that Togo are not going to be allowed to catch up with their games that they're missing through the 3 days of mourning. They're not going to be readmitted to the tournament. What's going to happen, therefore, to that group?
Well, I think let's go ahead as a three-team group, which obviously isn't ideal. I mean, there is the possibility that were Ivory Coast to slip up in either of their first two games, that Ghana and Burkina Faso could somehow arrange a result in the final game that they're ensure both went through. I think Ivory Coast are good enough, that's not really a concern. But you know, it is possible, and obviously that creates various issues. I think there is a possibility Togo may return to play some memorial match, which I think, you know, is quite a nice idea. It's sort of, it's a happy middle ground. I think rearranging the tournament to allow them to have this 3 days of mourning would have been all but impossible, and would have taken a huge sacrifice from the other teams in the group, as well as all the logistical problems. But to arrange some kind of memorial game, I think will be a nice tribute, and it will be a way of Togo to say, well, yeah, we're still here, we're still playing, and this is our way of commemorating those who died.
It doesn't seem that huge a sacrifice for one team, say, to have to reschedule a fixture, and equally it doesn't seem that sensitive of the organisers, but possibly that's my own mistaken impression. All right, well, the attention on the world was certainly on Angola for the opening game this weekend, and at least the tournament was granted a pretty extraordinary match with which to begin. Have you ever seen a game like this Angola-Mali affair, Jonathan?
Maybe in school football. Yeah, I was there, and I was writing three live match reports, so it wasn't ideal. But it's a very odd game. That, you know, 4-4 draw, you think for a minute, fantastically exciting. Well, I don't think it was a particularly good game, actually. I thought Mali were absolutely atrocious for 75 minutes. Really struggled to deal with the wing-backs of Angola, and I thought Gilberto was excellent for Angola. And they were well, without having played particularly well, they were well worth their 4-0 lead. But then as soon as Mali pulled one back, and the keeper, Carlos Fernandez for Angola, yeah, he panicked, the defence panicked. I mean, the defending in that last 5-10 minutes was appalling. And almost when the equaliser went in, you were almost expecting it to happen. I've never been at a game when a team's been 4-0 up and drawn 4-4. I was trying to work out last night, I think I've been to four games where I've seen a 3-goal lead overturned, but never in the space of 11 minutes. So, a very, very odd start.
Coming up in the African Cup of Nations over the next few days, a couple of big games. Certainly on Wednesday, Egypt-Nigeria. That looks like a cracker. We'll review that on Thursday. And, on Friday, Ivory Coast-Ghana. Right. Hopefully, football is the only thing we're going to be talking about this tournament from now on. And that's it for part one. Coming up in part two, the arrival of Kevin McCarra and some tip-top Premier League roundup.
Football Weekly from The Guardian, in association with SportingBet.com.
Part two, on to the football, what there was of it. Interesting. Genetic scientists stop mucking around with sheep and breed a snow pig that scoffs the snow and craps out road grit. I pay my taxes. Says, interesting. Only two Premier League games surviving this weekend. Kevin McCarra, you had the pleasure of being at one of them after an interminable train journey.
Yeah, coming back was to take a long time. We got home at 1 o'clock in the morning, but I was with Paul Hayward.
Right.
Splendid company, so that's a good aspect of it.
Yeah, it certainly could have been worse. What about this 1-1 draw then? From United's point of view, first of all, Man United, of course, were they unlucky, or is this further evidence of a decline?
I don't mind doing a bit of decline, but they certainly didn't turn domination into goals. I mean, I don't particularly like Wayne Rooney as a lone centre-forward because it seems to restrict what he can do in the game and he can't express himself. But they're really... There was, he had a chance and it was saved very well by Joe Hart. But although they kind of bombarded Birmingham in the first half, there wasn't a whole great repertoire of goalmouth opportunities. And I think Manu in that sense become quite dumb. Dull. There's problems there, of course, with Berbatov not playing. We're told he's got a knee injury, but his form, of course, has been fairly disastrous as well. Owen didn't get off the bench. So they passed the ball around very nicely, Manu, but lacked any sort of sting.
Where's the creation coming from, Kevin? Because Valencia does it now and again.
You're talking about Vidic or... No, he's Serbian, isn't he?
Valencia, the winger.
Right, no, go on.
Yes. You're talking about creativity. Yes, I think there's different problems. Paul Scholes now has become so old, he has to play in front of defence to save his legs. And that, what great news that is for the opposition. You have Paul Scholes at the edge of your penalty area, threading the ball through. He's playing passes to the wing or passes to the fullback and not hurting you. I mean, Scholes is a great player, and I can see why Ferguson wants to hang on to him somehow, but whether he really does you much good in that position, I would doubt. I think Valencia is good. I think his crossing the ball is excellent, but who was there to cross to? If Rooney gets frustrated and begins wandering off, there's virtually no one in the middle of the penalty area.
Right, Berbatov there talking about exploratory knee surgery, so that's what, at least a month out, you would think. Owen not even getting off the bench. Welbeck, what are the options for United?
Well, you would have thought Owen. I mean, you can't argue with Ferguson. He sees Owen every day and clearly isn't all that keen. But I thought when Owen scored his hat-trick in Wolfsburg and looked full of beans, in fact, scored the third goal in the 90th minute, so he looked fit. And the next game, he didn't start. Now, clearly, Ferguson watched him every day and is not impressed. But it must be a kind of vicious circle, because you wonder where Owen's confidence is going to come from if the manager doesn't think he's worth picking or even bringing on against Birmingham.
Well, Barry.
I was just going to say that Manchester United team doesn't seem to have much of an aura about it, and I wouldn't imagine other teams are going to be too intimidated by what the names they see on the team sheet. Rooney is possibly the only sort of player that would strike terror into your heart, and then you've got Carrick, Brown, Scholes, Park, Valencia. They just don't seem to be good enough to be Manchester United players.
I think the one thing I would say is if they do get their defence back at its fittest, and Vidic and Ferdinand, then the rest of the team will improve. I think Evra's a terrific left back, and I think if two centre halves are solid and the goalkeeping situation is not in doubt, then that helps the rest of the team. The other point I make is, of course, is that United don't have to be all that good. There aren't any great teams in the Premier League, and United are still right in the thick of it. Alright, they played a game more, but only a point behind Chelsea.
Well, I think that's an interesting point. I mean, I think the key question now is, will Chelsea, United and Arsenal find something, find that volume 11 on the stereo knob that like Arsenal in 97-8 or United in 2002-03 and suddenly kick on after Christmas? Or will the likes of Man City and Spurs actually say, right, we're going to make a five-way or six-way fist of it? Man City are 20-1 shots at the moment, but they're only 8 points behind. If they win at Blackburn tonight, they're in there, and let's hope so.
You keep on seeing the weaknesses, don't you? I mean, Arsenal, you wonder how they'll do without Alex Song, who's been a kind of latter day Vieira almost for them, and of course they didn't cope well.
But isn't that a great thing though? I mean, I think we've become so used to a boring missionary position style Premier League where the big four finish 1, 2, 3, 4. We know everyone else is going to roughly from 4th to 11th, then we know the teams are going to struggle. Let's just hope Spurs can get a little bit of gumption about them,
right?
And
that's what you're doing.
I know, I'm making a big fist pump.
It's the down with missionary position, up with six way fisting kind of thing that you seem to be espousing. That's worrying. But listen, that's all well and good. What about Birmingham though? That's now 12 games unbeaten, as we're all aware. How far? How long can this Birmingham team continue on this run? How far can they go, Sean Ingle?
Well, people are talking about Europe, but I would be amazed if they... I mean, I think you've got to give them all the credit in the world, and McLeish has somehow turned a team of journeymen and Cameron Drone and a couple of other good players into a decent side, but you've got to think they're going to finish probably mid-table rather than Europa League.
But why? Because if you're saying that Spurs and City can finish in the top four, why can't Birmingham finish in the top five,
please,
six, seven?
I've got a reason. Is it because part of the success is because he keeps using the same players 9 games in a row unchanged, and sooner or later he's going to burn out his players like that, isn't he?
I think that's one reason. I think the other reason is you look at the likes of Everton, you look at the likes of Sunderland, you look at the likes of Fulham, who are all below Birmingham at the moment, and think... Looking at the squads, they are probably better than Birmingham.
But they're professional athletes playing one, maybe two games a week, and they're playing in a team that's doing well. I don't think exhaustion or burnout is going to be a problem.
Do you not think that
they haven't picked up injuries yet.
No, they haven't. But if you're using the same 9 players every time, does that not mean that you don't have alternatives? And therefore, when you do almost inevitably pick up some injuries, your side's going to be weakened. Man United, just producer Ben insisted I mention this, on Saturday, using their 100th different lineup in a row.
Yes, I mean, part of that, of course, is fourth on number injuries, keeping having to change defenders. But they've got a big squad, and they're thinking about not the FA Cup anymore, of course, but they were thinking of various tournaments and fighting on all fronts. But to get back to Birmingham, they were in midfield, they were totally outclassed by Manchester United, particularly in the first half. And even the fullbacks weren't all that great, although Carr's been a bit of a hero this season. But Roger Johnson and Scott Dan, who unfortunately scored the equaliser for United, the centre-halves were absolutely terrific. I think Johnson was, what, £5 million? He's there with Richard Dunn, I think, is one of the sort of bargain buys of the season.
Is that what it is? Just rugged defending Birmingham? And
well, yeah, certainly Johnson and Dan are not going to bring the ball out for you in a sort of libero style, that's for sure. But it was interesting to see how ineffective people like Sebastian Larsson, Barry Ferguson, James McFadden were. Really, when it comes down to it, Birmingham are depending on that defence to hold the opposition at bay. And I don't think that will work indefinitely.
But I think Kev's been a touch harsh on like someone like Lee Bowyer, I think, has revitalised himself.
Oh, yeah, I just mean at the weekend. I'm not talking about... obviously, you've been doing well.
Good. Oh, all right, super. Now, the other game, of course, at the Emirates, Arsenal taking on Everton, and Everton very nearly getting the victory here. Who saw this game?
I did. I'm increasingly confident that I'll be taking yet another £20 off Barry Glendening come the end of the season if Everton finish 10th or higher. I mean, we say this every time, you know, the cliches about Arsenal are true. Every time they get a chance to really close the gap on Chelsea at the top, they don't take it. In fairness to them, though, they're still missing them. You know, when you miss Van Persie, when you miss
Fabregas,
you miss even Nicholas Bentner, which sounds a stupid thing to say, but they need someone leading the line. And
When are they due back? There's talk of Fabregas being imminently returning to the squad.
He's due to play on Sunday. Bentner is less clear because some Arsenal fans I speak to say that it could be quite soon, but he's had a few niggles, so it might even be longer. And Van Persie's not going to be back till late spring.
All right, they have some big games coming up in the league. They're away to Bolton. What will be Owen Corr's first game, presumably on the Trotters bench? Then they're away to Villa after that. Then they're home to fading force Manchester United. Then they're away to Chelsea. Then they're home to Liverpool. Woof. Big four teams, one after the other there.
2 years ago, February cost Arsenal the title. They drew, was it four games in a row, I think, from memory in the league against teams like Birmingham and I think Middlesbrough as well. This time around, January and February, I think these next five games could make or break their season.
Didn't Wenger speak almost enviously of Man U being knocked out of the FA Cup?
what about, from Everton's point of view, Mandon Donovan? Fantastic start for him back, in the Premier League.
Well, he set up Everton's first goal with a corner and played well. So, didn't score, but showed he should settle into life in England.
What does that mean about the standard of the Premier League? Or was it just Traore having a bit of a...
It puzzled me a bit because he'd been in Germany twice with Bayer Leverkusen and Bayern Munich and been unable to cut it. But he's certainly a tryer, isn't he? He's back for more. But I think you've got a point. I think Traore is very unsatisfactory sort of a replacement left back for Arsenal.
Great. Okay, well, Everton looking good. As long as Saha can stay fit as well, that's another big question.
I'd be interested to see whether Paul Dawes made his point before, whether someone does try and take him on during the transfer window.
Luis Saha?
Yeah, because, you know, Liverpool need a striker, Arsenal need a striker. I know he's 31 now, I think. So it may be that people don't want to spend big money on him, but they could do worse.
Man United as well, no? Good. Right. Well, one or two other miscellaneous bits of Premier League news to cover.
Sorry, can I just... Yeah. I thought the manner in which all the matches were postponed over the weekend was completely ridiculous. Why? Why were these games not played?
Right. Well, Liverpool, for example, they missed the game with Spurs, and if it could only keep snowing till the end of the season, they might just get away with that one. But you're not the only person to raise that question. Indeed. Ooh, Roger Palmer... saying, if Liverpool hypothetically want a game not to go ahead, surely they have a slight control over the ground staff just to leave a cover off or not quite manage to stop the pitch freezing. Are groundskeepers an independent group akin to the refs, or is the work ethic so strong that even in the face of their own employers asking their D's off, groundskeepers couldn't dream of letting the pitch not be playable? Do you think there's any suggestion that clubs might go, ooh, we could do without the fixture this weekend?
I think there's every suggestion. I'd say it's a certainty.
Yeah.
Quite a few clubs this weekend fancy
name
the weekend
names,
off.
Barry Glendinning.
Take your pick from any of the Premier League games, with possible exception with the ones like up north in Lancashire, maybe. I'm not sure how bad the grounds are, but you know, shopping centres are open, ice rinks are open, pubs are open, everything else is open. Why shouldn't football grounds
But people tend not to travel 6 or 70 miles to visit, say, Luton's Arndale Centre or Wandsworth.
I don't know, sure.
But, I mean, I do think there is difficulty getting, you know, travelling around the country if you're right. a fan. But I think Barry's right. Look at a team like West Ham, who've got a big injury crisis. If the game is in doubt, then, you know, they perhaps wouldn't be, you know, unamenable to the game being called off.
It's again a paradox that nowadays pitches are protected in a way they never were. I think yeah. the biggest problem is the surroundings and the fact that local authorities are reluctant to allow games to go ahead. I'm sure when I were a nipper, you could walk over sheets of ice to the game and no one cared if you broke your leg. I mean, they weren't going to call the match off. The only thing that mattered was the pitch. But nowadays they take into account all the environs.
Bye bye, Badman, saying, what's the betting that come July the ensuing fixture pile-up that all this causes is going to be used to excuse away England's inability to progress beyond the last eight of the World Cup?
I think that's absolutely true. Yeah. But it was far worse in 63, rather, far worse in 81, far worse in 86. We're talking basically about each team perhaps having to play one game, extra game now, from now to May, which is 3.5 months.
Now, one or two other bits of miscellaneous news. One of them regarding, of course, Liverpool Tom Hicks Jr., Barry Glendening.
Yeah, he's resigned as a board member of Liverpool.
Does this have any impact on the club at all, or is it just one of the owner's sons?
I don't think so. It's one of the owner's sons is no longer on the board or whatever. So but it's quite comical circumstances in which he's had to resign because the Spirit of Shankly, which are a fans union, published his email address on their website and encouraged Liverpool fans to send him emails voicing their displeasure at the manner in which their club is being run and the lack of transfer funds being made available to Rafael Benitez. Such was the zealousness with which Liverpool fans took to this task that Hicks Jr. finally snapped and responded to one correspondent by saying, and I quote, "Blow me fuckface."
Yeah.
So the Spirit of Shankly, were outraged at this. I'm sure it was false outrage because I'd imagine they were absolutely delighted to get this response from him and called for his resignation, which has duly been delivered.
Other news, Burnley need a new caretaker manager. Poor things. As Steve Davis has also done a bunk to join Owen Corr at Bolton. It's rotten. Rotten, isn't it? Sean?
And worse still, the current favourite is Brian Laws, who had a shocker at Sheffield Wednesday.
Right, Paul Ince, I believe, also being mentioned in the...
Has he been texting you again? Has he been back in contact after about 18 months?
I'm not going to discuss that here. West Ham, their goal-scoring crisis. Nuno Gomez, what do you think about that, Barry?
I thought Nuno Gomez had retired about 3 years ago, so I was very surprised when his name cropped up in passing as I wrote this morning's rumour mill. Mm-hmm. But I like Nuno. I don't particularly rate him very highly, and I think he scored a whopping 4 goals for Benfica this season.
Yeah, he once had a very good international tournament. I can't remember which one it was.
He spent more time on his striking and less time on his hair. He might have been a great, great forward, but not particularly good.
Ruud van Nistelrooy, who fares rather better on the on the hair goals ratio, linked to Stoke City. How many minutes has he played in the Primera División?
13.
13
this
minutes.
This season.
Right.
So Tony Pulis obviously liked what he saw.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if Stoke really need him because.
Does Nistelrooy
I meant to say in last week's podcast, and I forgot, Ricardo Fuller, when he came on, was magnificent for Stoke. And I know they haven't been scoring too many goals this season, but in that game against Fulham last week, they were, scored 3, loads of chances went to begging, and the last thing that looked like they needed was an ageing centre-forward.
Still, though, if you gave me a choice of James Beattie or Ruud van Nistelrooy, I think you'd go for van Nistelrooy, wouldn't you?
Right.
Even in his current incarnation, knack-prone, ageing, going to be on huge, huge money.
Yeah.
Don't know if they need him, but...
I can't see it happening, but...
Well, there you go. One thing that I can see happening is part 3, featuring Sid... And all sorts of other exciting things like Serie A talk, and there might be a smattering of a Paolo Bandini as well. Sid.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well. You, sir, are the big attraction of part 3 of Football Weekly, as I ask you such diverse questions as, what's Michel like? The bloke who's just gone, might be going to Birmingham. Is he any good?
He's all right. He's he's going to be, I think, in the Birmingham side amongst the more technically gifted players, and he's not a bad footballer, but I don't think he's a big star by any means.
All right, then. Now, Barcelona in crisis. Pa! They walloped Tenerife 5-0 away. A messy hat-trick.
Yeah, we really should learn. Well, I don't say, I mean, I shouldn't really say we, because I wasn't having a go. But people should really not to question Pep Guardiola, because every time this happens, they come back with something really big. Remember earlier in the season, there was lots of talk about a crisis, and they went and absolutely walloped Inter Milan, who admittedly were pretty rubbish themselves, and then beat Real Madrid. This time there was talk of crisis. It's a bit of a laugh. So I was saying, Barcelona haven't won all year. That would be all two games of this year. One of them, a Copa del Rey defeat, it must have said, against Sevilla at home, and also, of course, the draw with Villarreal. And they went to Tenerife and absolutely slaughtered them 5-0. However, there is an important little caveat to that, and that is that Tenerife were by far and away the better side for the first hour and could easily have been 2 or 3 up. Then after that, Barcelona came back into the game and just destroyed them.
5-0. Real, meanwhile, winning 2-0 in the snow against Mallorca. Higuain continuing his recent form.
Yeah, not just that, but scoring a really, really brilliant goal. It now makes him the top scorer for Real Madrid this season. I think that's 11 for the season, so it means the only people who scored more than him are David Villa and Leo Messi. And yet still the kind of campaign builds to put Benzema on the side rather than Higuain. And every time it seems that there's half a case for Higuain to lose his place, he comes back and scores goals. He missed two last weekend, two very good chances against Osasuna, and lots of people jumped on him immediately. He said, look, he misses chances. Good players can't miss chances like this. Forgetting, of course, that Cristiano Ronaldo missed a very good chance at the Camp Nou against Barcelona, and all sorts of other players missing good chances. And he scored a really brilliant goal yesterday that set up the game very, very nicely. And it just seems that right now, no matter what gets put in Gonzalo Higuain's way, he goes and scores goals. There was a poll in one of the papers this week in terms of the future, and saying that should Real Madrid let Gonzalo Higuain go to Arsenal in order to get Cesc Fabregas? And over 80% of people said, no, we'd rather have Higuain.
Interesting. Now, meantime, dearest AC Jimbo, you must have Dr. Sid talk to us about Racing Santander's 18-year-old Spanish sensation, Sergio Canales, the most exciting young player on the planet at the moment. This is from a man named Corleone, so you probably won't want to refuse his request. Fire away, Sid.
He's brilliant. Sergio Canales is absolutely brilliant. Obviously, it's perhaps a little early to go completely bonkers, although I am currently going completely bonkers. This is what I'm writing about today. Canales scored 2 goals against Sevilla at the weekend, got a standing ovation from the Sevilla fans. The first one, and I love this as well, he admitted after the game that he watched the Arsenal-Everton game and he saw Pienaar's goal and tried to replicate it. And he replicated that. I would say he bettered it. Clean through, one-on-one with the goalkeeper, scooped it over Palop and into the net. 10 or 12 minutes later, he was clean for again. Palop comes out to him, and you could almost sense Palop thinking, I'm not having this cheeky little bugger scoop it over me again. So Palop sort of waited a bit. He went round Palop, clean on goal. Defender came across. He paused, allowed the defender to slide past him like a cartoon character off a cliff, and then just rolled the ball into the net. Really, 2 brilliant goals. He's now scored 4 in his only 3 starts for Racing Santander this season. 18 years old. He looks very, very talented indeed. And he's completely turned them round to some extent. Not just him, the new coach has come in and changed a few other things. But Canales is the key creative force for a Racing side that was in the relegation zone when he really started getting a chance. He's now up in 12th place, has won 5 of the last 6. And he's been fantastically important for them. There's really bad news, though, for Racing fans. And that is that his contract's up at the end of the season, so he can already talk to other clubs, because they made a huge, huge cock-up of not getting him signed up sooner, and it looks like he'll be walking away.
On a free, how big are we talking, though, Sid? Are we talking about kind of decent forward like Aguero big, or are we talking about world player of the year type big?
Well, the first thing I'd say is to call Aguero just decent forward, I think, is selling Aguero very short. I think Aguero could well be a world player at some stage in the future. I think Aguero is that good. It's difficult to know for sure. Looking at the way he plays, there's people who suggest he's a bit like Julen Guerrero, and fans will be hoping not, because Guerrero, while he was a huge star in Spain for about 3 or 4 years, then disappeared a little bit. Stylistically, he's like Guti, but he's not as much of a, well, frankly, he's not as much of an idiot as Guti is, and I don't see him ruining his career in that sense, or at least not making the most of his talent. I think he could be a player that we'll see as a really great player, perhaps at the level of something like a David Silva. In other words, a very, very, very good player who possibly, until he goes and plays for a big British club, we wouldn't give him as much credit as perhaps he deserves.
But he's not going to go and do a Bojan Krkic or anything like that?
I don't think so, because I think you look at Bojan and you see perhaps a lack of physical presence now. Now, Canales is still fairly slight. He's not particularly tall, but he's very cool in possession. Bojan was a guy who just scored lots and lots of goals. Canales can clearly really play as well. So I do think he's probably going to be better than Bojan. I think he's going to be a very, very good player indeed. But, yeah, of course, as early as this, it's difficult to tell. The reaction in Spain is that this is the big kid of the last 5 or 6 years in terms of doing something really special.
Nice one, Sid. Listen, finally, Atletico finally won 4-0 away to Valladolid, and which leads me on to a question from DHG of Fern Hill. A question for Sid next time. Maxi Rodriguez, assuming his transfer stroke loan to Liverpool happens, has he turned pony or is this a steal? And if the latter, why the hell are Atletico letting it happen?
This is a really difficult one. I think the answer to this could be one of those deals where everybody wins. And everybody wins given the context. Now, obviously, the context is Liverpool don't have the money to spend to buy anyone very, very good. The context is that Atletico Madrid need to shed certain players from the squad because of their attitudes, because of their impact on other players, and also because of the financial situation. So here's a cheap player who's a very talented player. I mean, only you have to remind you, of course, of the goal he scored for Argentina against Mexico in the last World Cup, although that was now 3.5 years ago. He's a player who's been very, very effective for a long time in Spain. He's scored 15 or 16 goals for Espanyol, 15 or 16 for Atletico Madrid a couple of seasons ago, coming in from the right-hand side. But he's been absolutely awful this season. He's been pretty awful the back end of last season as well. There's a real feeling that his attitude isn't right, that he's not fully committed to Atletico Madrid. But then, of course, that could be good news for Liverpool, because I think Rafa Benitez is entitled to believe that the rut that Maxi is clearly in is called Atletico Madrid, and that leaving Atletico, given that he's got a World Cup at the end of the season, something to play for, could actually be what releases him. As for Atletico, it's great for them as well. This does look like the kind of deal that certainly in the short term could be good for everyone, but let's not expect him to be a brilliant player, because he's not going to be, but then Liverpool are buying him for free pretty much, so it's inevitable that he's not going to be that brilliant.
Sid Lowe in Madrid. England expects posting it with Togo's withdrawal from the African Cup. Do you think they'll offer the spot to Ireland? We've seen that one in one or two places, but subject matter notwithstanding. Yes. Anyway,
they'd
now, Paolo... What?
They'd probably take it. I wouldn't put anything past the FAI.
Right. Okay. Paolo Bandini.
Hello.
Welcome aboard. Nice to have you with us, Paolo.
Nice to be on board.
Well, indeed. Big weekend in Italy, Milan beating Juventus 3-0. What a miserable, miserable lot Juventus look like.
Yeah, I mean, it's this big thing now for several seasons. Who's going to be the anti-Inter? And obviously now it's Milan, which I think, to be honest with you, anyone who, other than Juventus fans and possibly Inter fans, was probably praying that it would go this way, because Milan looked like they could conceivably get within touching distance, whereas Juventus really, you know, if they'd won, it probably would have just been another of these little blips on the way down at the moment.
Like the one where they beat Inter bizarrely just before Christmas.
Precisely, yeah. But it was a terrible, terrible game. I mean, Juventus really are bad at the moment.
Yeah.
The first 20 minutes, I suppose you could give them some credit for closing down spaces and preventing Milan from getting anything going. And really, Milan didn't get much going all game either, but at least you felt with Milan, like, push came to shove, they'd probably create a couple of chances just because they had that sort of quality in the final third. With Juventus, it was just, other than Diego right at the beginning, once he cut in from the left and had a shot across goal, there was absolutely nothing going forward. I think Giorgio Chiellini had more attempts on target than anyone else in the team.
I mean, they're rubbish at the front, rubbish at the back, as Milan fan to their delight. There were homemade bombs thrown near the dressing room. There were flags and stuff set on fire in the stands.
Proper fires going in the stands. Yeah. I mean, by the end on the TV footage, you could actually barely see the third goal because it was Ronaldinho in the centre and it was just covered in smoke, the stadium.
What should we mean by homemade bombs? Are we talking Molotov cocktails?
No, they're kind of the bangers, really.
Yeah, they're bangers rather than bombs. They're not. I mean, I'm sure they could do you some damage if they were right next to you, but they're not serious.
But there were a lot of angry chants and stuff, including a lot of anti-Ferrara stuff, the manager, and
yeah,
also cries of tomorrow we're coming back with big sticks.
I mean, this was the big... The anti-Ferrara stuff was sort of the big news, just because up until now, they've had a go at just about everyone except Ferrara, actually, the Juventus fans. They've been quite patient with him, and this is sort of being seen as the turning point where they're saying, actually, you're not doing your job well, so you can do one. But there was all pro-Moggi and anti-everyone who's there, basically, was the chance going on.
Headline on... 2-2. Sorry, Barry.
I was just going to say, you'd have thought they'd have started with the big sticks and then chanted, tomorrow we're coming back with homemade bomb.
Right. Well, two to sports headline this morning. Hiddink quick. They say Ferrari's at the end of the line. Please stop the agony, their editorial there. Any truth, do you think, in this idea that Gus is standing by for a call from the old lady?
It still seems pretty unlikely to me, especially with the sums of money that are being quoted. But, you know, the one thing I would say is Tutto Sport is one of those newspapers that really defines the sports coverage in Turin. And it also, when it tends to, you know, it could be like a dog with a bone. It's not going to let go once it gets onto something. So I think that it will now continue to harangue Ferrari until they move on him, whether or not Hiddink is a realistic option to come in. I know some of the papers were saying this morning that he's quit his holiday in Kenya, I didn't realise he was on holiday in Kenya, to be honest with you, until I read it. But I thought it was, is he actually quit his holiday or has he just gone home? But, we'll see.
Right. Well, next up, they face Napoli in the Coppa Italia. Napoli, who at the weekend went 12 games unbeaten under their manager, Walter Mazzarri, with a 1-0 win over Sampdoria, which keeps them in a fourth place. Just on the subject of Juve, in the next league game, they're going to be without, Amauri, the man who scores about one goal a year.
Yeah,
Del Piero on his own up front, is it?
Yeah, the striker situation is getting really bad there because Trezeguet is injured. Quinta, who was their top scorer with something like 4 goals in 8 games, which tells you something about their attack, but he's been injured for a while. Jovinko's now injured. They're trying to get Davide Lanzafame back from Parma, who's there on loan and does co-ownership, as it always is in Italy. And there's also talk of them now. They've sort of offloaded a bunch of players like Thiago on loan. They may try and buy someone else. I mean, Pazzini's been mentioned, but I'd be surprised again. I think it's more likely they'll try and get in someone like Lanzafame they can do on the cheap.
Bad though it is for Juventus, could be worse. They could be neighbours Torino, who in the second division lost to Cittadella this weekend and then changed manager for the third time this season. Mario Barretta getting fired. Always a little that I enjoy. And they brought back the man that they fired to bring him in on the 28th of November, Stefano Colantuono. That was after a game that they lost at home to Crotone, a game that is now subject of investigation from presumed illicit betting.
It's been an unbelievable week for Torino, because it's not only that, but then in the same day that it was announced that that game was going to go under investigation, their players were attacked in a restaurant by a group of about 20-odd fans. They were having a big dinner to celebrate Di Michele's birthday, and a group of 20 or so hooligans came in masks and started punching them and slapping them in front of their families. Then they talked about going on strike, and then the club said, no, we're not going on strike. And it seems as if some of the players wanted to go on strike, actually, and the club sort of said no. So now these players are saying, well, that's it, we want out. So you've got half the squad's trying to leave. You've brought back the manager who was in charge for this game, which is now under investigation, and you've got players getting beaten up in a restaurant by fans.
It's all a far cry from when they were playing in Europe with Benito Carboni, and, right. And they were a good side back then.
Well, I don't know, Torino, they used to be kind of top three, top four material. There we go. Now, of course, the other thing we need to talk about, Barry Glendening, is one of my favourite players, Massimo Macaroni. I swivelled my monitor around towards you this morning and showed you a pretty special bit of Macaroni action, didn't I?
Yes, Macaroni scored a wonderful goal.
Wonderful. That was from
curled it from the edge of the penalty area, around the keeper
out.
And
into the bend
top
on
right hand corner.
Mm.
Beauty.
One of the goals of the season, anywhere. I would suggest. I'll give the link, the hyperlink to Uber producer Ben, and he can post it up at the top. But that was actually from back mid December. He scored another cracker this weekend as Siena went to Inter. Now, just to set this one up for you, Jose Mourinho hadn't lost a league game at home in his time at Inter or in his time at Chelsea. In fact, not since 2003, when he was manager of Porto, had he lost a league game at home. Siena turned up at the home of Inter, top of the table. Siena, bottom of the table. They had lost all their away games since August. What happens? They go 1-0 up, then they go 2-1 behind. Then they come back, they make it 3-2. Two goals from Macaroni, one of which an absolute stunner. 89th minute, they're winning 3-2. Paolo Bandini.
Yeah, and then Inter win a fairly soft free kick. I mean, it was the sort of free kick that you would get given in any country sometimes and wouldn't get given other times. It's not one of those ones that was scandalous, but equally you could see why Siena felt like it maybe shouldn't have been given. And Wesley Snyder just smacks it in from 35 yards. And you're making a signal at me.
It was his second. He had two free kicks and he scored on
Snyder
both.
Snyder had already scored earlier in the game, but this one was, the first one was, did decent free kick, but this was a really long way out. You really didn't think he'd even have a go from there, and he put it right in the corner where the keeper had no chance getting it. And then, a couple of minutes later, Samuel nicks a winner for them, and you know, inevitably Siena were absolutely livid because of this free kick, and Mourinho after the game took the Siena manager Malassani into his changing room before he even spoke to the press, and they had a nice long chat, and then came out and said almost exactly what you would have expected them to say anyway, which was Mourinho saying, well, I think it was all right, and Malassani saying that he was so upset he couldn't speak, and you know, and it sort of rumbled on.
He obviously could speak, couldn't he?
Well, yeah, I think he said about five words though. He didn't say many words. But then the Siena players have all sort of come out and said the same things, that it's a scandal. And Cristiano Del Grosso was saying, you know, I'd love to be able to come to Inter one day and outplay them and win, but I know this can never happen in this league because they'll always get these decisions. So.
No, all happy in Serie A. The Macaroni, though, is he not the one that got away? He's always been a very special player.
No.
I think he's one of those players who scores great goals, but it's a Darren Huckabee thing, isn't it? He's a scorer of great goals, but is he a great scorer of goals? I don't think that he really is, but he does, you know, he comes up with these finishes with, you know, not irregularly for Siena, but his strike rate isn't that great.
He scored a couple of goals for Italy under-21s against England under-21s. Mm. We all went wild about him. He then played several mediocre seasons at Middlesbrough.
Yeah, when he was allowed a chance on the field.
But God, he was hardly up against, you know, Ronaldo and, you know, Romario at their peaks, was he?
I suppose not. Always been a bit of a Macaroni fan.
Is that because you look like him?
That's true. That's why. That's why. I like shortish, bald players with the tendency to put a little weight on around the waist. So let's think of some other players that I enjoy. Fabian Barthez, Ivan Bandela Peña. Who are your favourite players, Sean Ingle? Gary Neville? No. It's your favourite player is, what's the bleeding bloke's name? Gareth Southgate. Ooh,
that's cool.
He's not coming back from that one. He's on the floor. The referee's speaking.
Sorry, I can't speak.
Way to go to stay on tone. Anyway, that's it for today's Football Weekly. Many, many thanks for joining us, Barry.
Show me fuckface.
Many, many... Sean and Paolo Bandini. And Kevin, you know, who's here before. And you, the listener, as ever. We will be back on Thursday with Football Weekly Extra. Perhaps you'd like to join us for that. In the meantime, from all of us here, it's goodbye.
Football Weekly Extra from The Guardian, in association with SportingBet.com.